It's right behind us.
Starting in the morning, we'll finish in the afternoon.
May it please the court. Justices, I represent Mr. Opaletto, and I kept my point short. He was found guilty. I told the jury when we were arguing sentencing that I respected their finding. I think you know the issue. An extra sentencing verdict was sent to the back. And then to add insult to injury, now Captain Giles and now Sheriff Giles, who was acting as bailiff, advised the jury that it was an additional charge or additional thing, and to look into it and to consider it all. The timing is important, and Mr. Campbell, in his brief for the Attorney General's office, I think is very specific about all the things that I did wrong in the particular case, and when I should have done this and how I waived that. But I bring to your attention quickly because I think it's important. In court, when they read the sentencing verdict, I said I reserved my motion. The way I understand the Attorney General's brief is I waived my motion. I did not waive my motion. I reserved my motion. Then it was up to the judge to determine when I should give that motion.
Well, to be fair to the AG on that question, I think what he said was that you may very well have said that, but the jury retired, and that constitutes a waiver.
Were they dismissed?
Yeah.
And that's different. I mean they didn't retire to deliberate.
Dismissed. You're exactly
yes,
right.
So I
think the AG's position is that when the jury is dismissed and you haven't made the argument for a mistrial at that point in time, that you do not have the ability, reserved or not, to make the motion. But I'll hear from the AG.
Yes, sir.
But I think that's what he means by it.
Well, I'm glad we put a point on it. I think the Maxwell case, as I stated in my brief, that's kind of two cases, Roe and Maxwell.
Right.
The Court of Appeals relied on Roe, which was a retiring jury, to deliberate case as opposed to a dismissing jury. And what I understood Maxwell to say on the Maxwell part of the case was that a motion was timely made post-trial. I would assume as long as it's still in the breast of the court, but of course we were still in the breast of the court because we had the entire sentencing hearing to go through with Judge Lee.
The difference between your case and Maxwell, at least with regard to the first motion that you made, the facts in Maxwell would indicate that the information did not come to the knowledge of the defense counsel until after the jury had been dismissed.
Yeah, the judge mentioned it.
And so your case is sort of a hybrid of the two cases. The information came to you. You did what the lawyer in the second case did, was I need to make a motion. But the jury was already gone when you made the basis of your motion, so the court couldn't take any action to cure the problem.
Yes, ma'am. And so I, two-pronged, I think it's kind of a continuation of a single problem because it all resulted from the extra jury instruction or the extra sentencing instruction. So the jury read six, Gary Williams, our clerk, read six findings, and we all looked at each other when the one came out about the threat of the clerk because we knew that had been null pros. And so I reserved my motion at that point. Judge Lee did his cordial list with the jury and let them go and thank them. My motion was reserved. It was at that point Sergeant Giles came over, the help speech officer, and was whispering to Ms. Ramsey. And she interjected, Captain Giles has just told me that the foreman had inquired of him that they had an extra instruction. And he said, it's extra, we'll read into it. Which leads me to believe what he said was, it's extra. You convicted him of these. Now, here's another one. Sentence him on that one, too. And so the jury, the foreperson said, okay, I understand, and retired. So it is a hybrid, Justice Powell, because half of it, we could argue that I should have told Judge Lee, don't let the jury retire. Don't dismiss the jury because certain safeguards. But on the second part, and the much more, I'm not going to say egregious because nobody did anything for the purpose, But the worst problem we have is the fact that one of the highest ranking law enforcement officers in our county told the foreman, you know, there's an extra charge.
And I don't disagree with you. Part of your issue occurs before the jury is dismissed. Part of your issue occurs after the jury is dismissed. As I understand the Attorney General's argument, and it may be borne out by your statement, as I understand what the deputy told them, you waited until the first sentencing hearing to raise the issue of the bailiff's discussion with the jury, even though you knew about that at the end of the trial. It gets carried over to the second sentencing hearing before the arguments are actually made, and by the time the court finally hears it, nobody really remembers what the bailiff said. The bailiff doesn't remember what the bailiff said, and you are repeating to the court what you thought the bailiff said, which doesn't match what the transcript of the case said the bailiff said. And so it's a compound problem, compounded by the fact of the passage of time and the failure to bring the motion. And so address for me why that, too, isn't waived by the passage of time.
Yes, sir. So what I said was this is all one problem that kind of gets worse. Judge Lee admits that he should have caught the jury the sentencing instruction when he sent it back. So it was sent back. I objected to that on the record, whether I could have controlled the court enough to say don't dismiss them. I mean, he said on the record it's 10 minutes to find they did their job. So whether I could have had any control, I don't know. But I reserved my motion. I reserved it.
But you realize, based upon the questions we've been asking you, there's no such thing as reserving your motion if the law requires it to be timely made. You can't say, well, I reserve the right to make an untimely motion later. There's just no such thing.
I do understand that.
Okay.
But I also understand that when that fellow in that room does what he does, I have very little control. It's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Everybody's ready to go home. You can read the tenor of the transcript. Everybody had done a good job that day, and the jury had done their job. And I said I reserved my motion. I think it's timely made. I think that the Maxwell case says, because there was still a sentencing hearing to go, even an objection made. You know, and Justice Powell, I misstated exactly or misquoted the sheriff, but I knew that what he said was meaningful. And I think by all of these questions about whether I did anything wrong, I think I can assume that the court might think if I didn't waive it, it might mean something. Otherwise, we wouldn't need to talk about it.
Aren't there really two different things? I mean, there's one argument that that you certainly could have made before the jury was dismissed. And that was your request for a mistrial because of the sixth sentencing form, right?
Yes. I could have asked for them to retire again so I could make it outside of their presence,
right,
instead of be dismissed.
That's right, and you did.
I did make that motion.
Right.
I'm not sure it would have been great.
And then you've got the other issue of the deputy speaking to the jury, and that really, you didn't find out about that until the jury was gone. So, I mean, that did, you know, that through no. Okay.
They weren't hardly out of the building, but because to Ms. Randy's credit, as soon as she knew it, she made it.
Right.
And that's what I want to zero in on that. They weren't hardly out of the building. Kind of how long after their dismissal was that brought to the court? Were they truly, you know, out of the building, or were they back in a break room or something?
Those are just members. Okay. So what happened, as I remember it, I think it bears out. I read this again last night. They came back in and were standing before the judge after the verdict. After Gary Williams, our clerk, read the verdict, the judge told them, hey, we had an extra one, but I'm just going to avoid that. I'm going to not sentence him to the 4 years that you sentenced him to. Thank you very much. They already had their pocketbooks and everything, and they were headed out the front door. They weren't going back out of the back door. So it was another minute, I guess, because I was making, I think I made my motion, my standard motion to strike that the evidence wasn't, I can't think of what it was. And then I made the second motion, post-trial motion for a mistrial. And it was during that motion that I was overruled. The judge ruled on several other things. Then we were talking about setting the sentencing hearing. and I said something and caught, and Ms. Ramsey wasn't listening, and she said something to the effect of, what was that? I'm sorry, I didn't hear what she said. And I said, I ask you to run the time concurrent. That's what it was. I asked her to run the time concurrent. And she said, but Captain Jobs was just telling me what. So between a minute and 5 minutes, just.
So, and I don't know your courthouse, but if the judge had, if a motion had been made, the bailiff or someone would have had to go out on the street and find those individuals and actually bring them back into the building.
We do have an elevator, but it's two floors, and so they would have been long out of the building in that amount of time.
Okay.
And dispersed.
All right, thank you.
Well, could the judge have questioned the deputy at that, with, even though the jury's gone, questioned the deputy and you and everyone else that might have something to say about it other than the jurors?
Well, the deputy did testify. That's exactly what he said. And, I mean, it's on the record.
Did he do it that day?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Deputy Sheriff Giles, now, this is what he said. The foreperson asked, Your Honor, and he's addressing Your Honor. She said she learned that.
Can I stop you just to put this in context? So the Commonwealth's attorney says, wait a minute, the deputy said something to me about having talked to the jurors. And then the judge. Like, well, what did you say?
Yeah, so, but, okay. So exactly, yes, sir. But I say, will you run the time concurrent on my knee? And Ms. Ramsey said, I can't do that. But Captain Giles was just telling me that he was approached by the foreperson about the additional form. The very next line on 224 of the big transcript, Captain Giles says, the foreperson asked, Your Honor, she said she learned that the verdict was different. It was just that extra one in there. I told them to read into it. It's different charges there. That's the key. It's not the same exact charges. It's a different charge on each one of them. And that's when she said, okay, I understand, and went back in.
And
that
so
was, that was,
and then what happened after that? What did the judge say? What did you say?
Ms. Ramsey, she said it actually works in the defendant's favor. He's given less time than the jury meant to give him, meaning the judge struck the four years. And then the court says, I'm not granting a mistrial. I do see the confusion, though. But, well, I don't see the confusion. They had the verdict form. I wish they'd made us aware of it. They did. The sheriff aware of it. But, you know, we ask a lot of our juries, and it's 5:10. They did give it their full consideration. Do you have a motion for a pre-sentence report? Do you want to go forward with sentencing?
But, counsel, at that point, when the judge says, I'm denying the mistrial, was not the judge responding to your request for a mistrial about the extra form? Because as I read this transcript, at that time, you did not make a motion for a mistrial with regard to the comment. That was when you came back for sentencing. Is that
and
correct?
And I don't mean to keep spinning this around, but I see them as one thing. And I think I feel like Judge Lee did, too. I'm don't grant your mistrial based on the sixth sentencing form. I don't grant you a mistrial based on the new knowledge about the six.
Which page are you reading from about the new knowledge? Which page of the JA?
That's where I just read,
225. Right. 225?
Line 8.
And he says new knowledge?
No, he doesn't say that. No, I paraphrase that. He says, I'm not granting a mistrial, which is basically him answering a question that I felt like I had asked. Anyway, again, now that we found that, I guess Justice Kelsey would be the difference in me saying it out loud or not, because he said it again that he denied it.
Well, I was thinking the same way Justice Powell was thinking, that he's denying what the only motion has been made.
But I didn't remake it. Why repeat yourself if right after Captain Giles hadn't thrown that time bomb on us? Why say it again?
You make the motion for a mistrial once you find out six forms went back.
Yes.
Then Ms. Ramsey disclosed, and you're asking, you've moved on, you're asking that things be, sentences be run concurrent.
Yes, sir.
Commonwealth attorney says, wait a minute, bailiff had a conversation with the jurors. You don't say, and judge, I want a mistrial. You all go on to discuss something else, or correct me if I'm wrong.
Judge,
can I just jump in? Because my understanding of the way you read the transcript, they didn't discuss anything else. I mean, when the fellow said, when the Commonwealth attorney says, you know, the bailiff, the captain, has been talking to these people, and the judge immediately has the captain say what he had said, and then he says, I'm not going to grant a mistrial. Right? I mean, the judge was the next person who spoke after the captain spoke.
Captain Giles says what he says, which I read. Ms. Ramsey says it actually works in his client's favor. And then the court says, I'm not granting a mistrial, which I felt like, why then say, but, Your Honor, let me put it on the record that I'm asking for a mistrial based on this. He said, I guess he would have said.
Because he'd already ruled on the other mistrial, right?
And then he said, I'm not granting a mistrial, period. And that would have been the point where I should have made my objection or my motion for a mistrial, but he beat me to the punch. I mean, I'm not trying to shirk responsibility, but.
So he denies your mistrial, and then on page 222 of the transcript.
So you can interpret him as denying your first mistrial twice, or him denying the first mistrial and then saying, I deny again after he hears additional information.
You started to say something, and all that we know is that you said, but I, and I'm on 222 at the bottom of the page. No, I'm sorry. Okay, so wait. I'm looking at two different numbers, 233.
Well, he's getting his pages straight. What the judge says after Ramsey makes the disclosure. I'm sorry, you found it. Go ahead.
Yeah. So he denies your motion, and then he says, is there a motion as to sentence? And then you say, but I, and then the court says, you've made your motion for a mistrial. I'm denying it. Your objection is noted for the record.
Second time.
And so when you said, but I, that was the intention of bringing that, but
yes,
you
sir.
Didn't, but you never did, get, you didn't get it on the record that day.
As far as he let me get.
Yeah.
That's an interjection.
Yeah, I've been there and done that.
Yes, sir.
So, okay.
Look at 237, and I hate to take up your time on this, but I'm really trying to understand if you guys were speaking past each other. The judge's response is, I'm not going to grant a mistrial. I do see the confusion, though, I don't see the confusion. They had the verdict form. I wish they had made us aware of it. But, you know, we ask a lot of our juries, and it's 10 to 5. They did it and given it full consideration. So he's still talking, I think, about the forms. Go ahead with your argument, counsel.
I guess I never even thought about that, but I guess because I was there and I thought we had a meeting of the minds, I just thought I was shut down. I could have said 10 more times, Judge, I want a mistrial. And he did this, I guess, walked out.
He would have taken some action against you about time number five.
Not Judge Lee. I'm way over time, but the final thing is, if you do find that I didn't waive my rights away, I think that exactly what Sheriff Giles says would, it certainly is about a matter in front of the jury. I mean, it's a communication, so the two-prong test is, was there a communication, and if there was it about a matter in front of the jury, or was it about where to eat lunch? And so I think it's a matter about the jury. I think a reasonable juror could have thought he was saying, hey, you got a sentence, I know you only found him guilty of 5, but now you got a sentence in the 6. And they could have said, oh.
Let me ask a question, another question, please. If we agreed with you that your motion was timely, that it is questionable whether it impacted the jury, what is the remedy?
Yes, ma'am. Ethically, I have to say I agree with the attorney.
Okay.
I'd love to have a new trial, but ethically, I can't.
Thank you.
Officially, afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Aaron Campbell, and I represent the Commonwealth in this case. We are asking the court to affirm based on the grounds that the defendant did not make a timely objection to either of his.
Suppose hypothetically that a fair reading of the transcript is that the post-jury dismissal statement by the court, I'm not doing a mistrial, in context could fairly, maybe not dispositively, but fairly be understood to be related to the very conversation the judge just heard from the deputy. That would be timely, though, wouldn't it? If the court was basically intuiting a continuing motion based upon a new circumstance, we would get over the timeliness point, not for the pre-jury dismissal, but the post-jury dismissal point.
Yes, hypothetically, if you could read into that that encompassed any argument as to the third-party contact with the jury.
So address the questions that you've heard us, the members of the court ask. Why isn't it at least a fair reading that that probably, although not certainly, was what the judge was thinking when the judge heard the deputy's statement and then said, well, look, we're done here. I'm denying the motion if there is a motion, or continuing the motion, or whatever. We're just done. I don't think it's a big deal. I'm moving on.
I don't read this as... I read it like Justice Powell, I think, read it. I'm not sure. I'm not going to put words in your mouth. That he was talking about the first motion, because there has never been anything on pages 236 to 237 raised by the defendant that this contact with the jury from the jury board person was inappropriate.
Right, but at trial you see the lawyer pop up and the court just overruled or jumps in or whatever, and so you have immediately preceding this conversation with the Commonwealth attorney and the deputy, the lawyer saying, and then the court shuts it down.
Now,
so
that occurs on page 235 before Captain Giles testifies, but he makes a statement on the record. The "but I" came on 235 of the appendix. And then after that, they're talking about the pre-sentence report or the argument for concurrent time. And then at that point, the prosecutor chimes in and says, "Captain Giles has been telling me that he had a conversation with the jury board person." And then Captain Giles gets on the record and says what he said. And then the prosecutor gets on the record and says, "Well, I don't think that the defendant was prejudiced by this third-party conduct." And the court says, that's when he says, "I'm not granting a mistrial." But at no point right here did the defendant argue that this, wait a minute, this is a whole new thing, this third-party conduct.
What about the Commonwealth attorney's statement that "I don't think he was prejudiced by what you just heard from the deputy," which you said immediately preceding the judge ruling about the mistrial?
Yeah, what the prosecutor says it actually works in the defendant's favor. He's given less time than the jury meant to give him, which is kind of goes to the first point that...
Counsel, that when he... I'm on that same page you are, but at that point, that was the third time he had said, "I'm not granting a mistrial." There was a motion for a mistrial, and he denied it. Mm-hmm. And then counsel stood up, and as soon as he denied it, said, "But I..." And the judge says, "I'm not granting a mistrial." And then two pages later, for the third time, he says, "I'm not granting a mistrial." What more could have been asked of the judge at that moment, in real life?
Asked of the judge or defense counsel?
Asked of the judge,
I think what needs to be asked is the defense counsel needs to raise an objection that this is a third-party contact between a juror and a bailiff, and that there is... a process that happens when we have that. The defendant has
The jury is already scattered to the four winds. It's not as if, he eventually made the motion, but what prejudice was there to the process from the... And he brought it to the judges. He brought what he believed to be the universal complaint to the judge, that there's this extra four. And there's actually two aspects of it turns out. It's the extra form.
If I might add a friendly amendment to Justice Mims' question, why isn't this Maxwell? Even if I read the transcript, as you read the transcript, why isn't this Maxwell, as Justice Mims said, how is he prejudiced when at the very next hearing he brings the motion? There's nothing more or less that the judge could have done. Part of the equation is when the judge is in a position to correct the problem.
Well, I think a couple things. In Maxwell, he wasn't on the record when they learned that the court had a conversation with the jurors.
Well, I'm looking at the timing. In Maxwell, the jurors were already gone, so there was nothing else they could do.
Yeah, and then when the judge told them that I had this conversation, it wasn't on the record, unlike this case where it's on the record. So we have a record being made. And the court, I mean, the defendant could raise this issue. And the second thing, and I think maybe more toward Justice Mims' question, here is the prejudice. There is a presumption of prejudice that applies under Bremer. And to wait 4 months to raise this issue is very prejudicial to the Commonwealth because, as we saw in this case, people didn't remember what happened. In fact, it ended up getting continued out to another 3 months, so 7 months. So that is the prejudice to the process and to the Commonwealth by not raising this in a timely manner.
What baffles me is why no one retrieved the record from the hearing, from the trial itself. Everybody's trying to remember what the bailiff said, trying to ask the bailiff what he said.
Okay. And it's all on the record.
It is baffling. And I think it's indicative of the problem, and one of the problems in this case, it invites error because they're relying on these memories when we could have just got the record and addressed it.
As I understand Remmer, once he raises the problem, then it's the Commonwealth's burden to rebut the presumption.
Right. I mean, as long as he makes a prima facie case that there was improper conduct. And our argument is that he could have made that on the record at the hearing, and the court could have put the bailiff on the stand under oath and asked him what was said, and the parties could have questioned. And then at that point, maybe they couldn't have gone and retrieved the jurors from the parking lot or wherever, but at least they could have set a hearing to have a hearing under Remmer.
So given what the bailiff did say and what we have on the record, he said, what is your position concerning whether or not there was prejudice based upon the...
Yeah, if there is prejudice, I have to, in all candor, if this has been preserved and this is, and the court finds that this is error, I think the Commonwealth has a very heavy lift because the Commonwealth didn't put on evidence that this didn't influence the jury. I think... It's very conceivable that this statement was just innocuous and that this had no influence on the jury. They were going to give
it. But the presumption goes against you if that's conceivable.
Yeah, but I recognize that there is that presumption and it's a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard.
So one last question based upon Justice Goodwin's question. What more would have been done if he had said, Your Honor, you just denied my motion for mistrial because I'm the only one here asking for mistrials. I take it to mean you understand that it applies to this last thing that just happened that you just questioned the deputy on. Is that right? Yes, Mr. Kelsey. All right. What more would need to be done other than, well, you've just found out there's an improper contact and there's a presumption of prejudice and... The prosecutor gave an explanation that's sort of lame and it doesn't rebut the presumption. I mean, what more would be done? If we'd done everything exactly right, what would the transcript look like?
I mean, I think you at least alerted the court to the problem, and they could have the court could have made that determination right then and there whether or not they need to have a further hearing under Remmer. If nothing could be done, nothing could be done. We have to have a new sentencing hearing.
And that's the remedy here if you lose on waiver?
A new sentencing hearing would be our position. I don't think the opposing counsel has to concede at that point. We don't condone, this is a messy case, we don't condone what the bailiff did. Sometimes I refer to it as the bad bailiff case.
He wasn't bad. He was trying to be helpful.
I think he was trying to be helpful.
It was improper.
Yeah.
I know other bailiffs who have thought they were judges.
Yeah. But objections need to be made in a timely manner. We believe that this case should be affirmed because both the objections to the forms and the improper contact with the bailiff and the jury foreperson was untimely. If there are no other questions, I'd ask that the court affirm.
All right, thank you very much. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.